From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today,
I've not seen this dark of a public mood in the entire decade that we've been doing this work.
The Center for Michigan talked to thousands of Michiganders and found few of us trust our state government to get the job done.
It's very difficult to have trust in a government that has, over a long period of time, declined to respond to its citizens.
Tales from the Lions sideline and locker room with offensive tackle Lomas Brown.
It's always, they say winning cures all, that's the truth.
Primo and Gustafson give us their new take on old American and Swedish tunes.
It's interesting when you find the lyrics that written more than 100 years ago, but you still can interpret it today.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. How much do you trust your state government and its ability to, do its job? The Center for Michigan spent the past year asking that very question of thousands of Michiganders. The overpowering response, we have an alarmingly low trust in our state government. All the details are in a new report that's just released today, Fractured Trust, Lost Faith in State Government, and How to Restore It. John Bebo is the president and the CEO of the Center for Michigan. It's always good to see you, John. Thanks for being here today.
Cynthia, it's so good to be back with you.
So you've been holding 125 community conversations all over Michigan and not only talking to, but polling thousands of people and asking them what exactly.
We spent 2016 really trying to measure people's perceptions and trust levels in their state government. We felt it was a crucial moment to do so. Think back a year. It's the middle of the Flint water crisis. And we wanted to really probe where people stood on how they thought state government was doing generally across the board. And we've been doing this work for 10 years. We've been out there. We've held more than 1,000 community meetings across the state. We've polled and questioned statewide residents, 40,000 of them over the decade, on their priorities for Michigan's future. And, you know, you'd think with the economy doing better now and unemployment relatively low and jobs coming back and whatnot, that people would be more hopeful. Just the opposite is true. I've not seen this dark of a public mood in the entire decade that we've been doing this work.
And the language that you use in this report, not just low trust, but alarmingly low trust. What do the numbers tell us? How low?
Across every issue that we polled and asked people about, majority low or very low public trust on every kind of government service that we asked about. Education, protection of public health, environmental protection, services for low-income residents, fostering economic growth. Those are all roles of state government in some fashion. Across the board, people are saying they don't trust state government to get these things done.
And as you say, when you think that we're supposedly with an improving economy and things moving up, you would think people would feel better. So what are they saying to you in these conversations? What are you hearing from people that supports this alarmingly low view?
To give you an anecdote that we quote in our report, a citizen told us in one of our community meetings, it's very difficult to have trust in a government that has, over a long period of time, declined to respond to its citizens. You know, there was no trust prior to this, but the Flint situation has literally destroyed our faith. I think we're seeing a tipping point here between cynicism and just outright discounting of some basic tenets and rules of government at this point. I think raw nerves were extremely common as we were out holding community meetings. The mood was dark everywhere we went. I think it was the Flint situation combined with the ugliness of the presidential election. We sensed a kind of populism that you saw that helped lead two populist candidates in Michigan, Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, find success here in the campaign. I also sensed there was another thing in play here, that public will is just not generally being acted upon. As I look back at all of these reports that we've come in and talked to you about over the years, there have been some victories, some things that citizens wanted have gotten done. But a number of other things just continually go unaddressed.
Such as?
In Lansing, infrastructure. The citizens have been saying for years that we need to fix our roads and our pipes and whatnot. What happened? Flint. That's an infrastructure problem. There was a half-measure road issue got approved. Now, what just happened? The Governor Snyder's new infrastructure commission just released a report a few weeks ago. This is a Republican governor set up a commission appointed by the Republican governor. This is not a cabal of liberals. They said $60 billion over the next 20 years is the infrastructure need in our state. Okay. Is that being talked about in Lansing right now? No. You've heard me come in here year in and year out and talk about different aspects of the education system. We need to improve our education performance. We need to improve college affordability. This is what the public keeps telling us. College affordability isn't getting better. Student loans will be billions of dollars this year in Michigan. And K-12 performance continues to sink. So what are we talking about in Lansing right now? What's going on under the dome?
We are talking about a big, huge tax cut.
A complete disconnect from what we're hearing in these community meetings. We didn't hear of the people crying out across the state in the past year or in any year for a $4 a month tax cut. But even after that failed in January, that's right now what the focus is in the House and the Senate in Michigan, trying to find $1 billion in cuts to fund a tax cut. Who's asking for the tax cut?
Which leads to an issue that people had, which was on campaign finance transparency, right?
Yeah, there are two key recommendations that come out of this report that the public would really like to see. One is better campaign finance transparency. Who's funding campaigns today? It's easier than in the past to conceal or hide exactly where money's coming from because of the way committees are structured. And that question has to be in play here in this tax cut.
Because you've got to say who's driving the agenda.
Who's driving this agenda? The business groups in Michigan generally are not calling for an income tax cut. The public isn't calling. Who's calling for this? So where's that coming from? And I think it plays directly into what we're hearing out there, which is a call for more transparency in campaign finance. So that's number one. I think that's dead on arrival. I don't see any sense that that's going to be something that this legislature is going to take up. So it's a little bit like shouting at brick walls here.
Which is what people are saying to you. They feel like they're shouting at brick walls and nobody's listening.
Exactly. And as someone who goes up to Lansing and tries to amplify these public views, that's how I feel too. But the second recommendation I think we have a little more hope for, which is reform of the state's emergency manager law. The public would really like to see a better balance between state intervention and local financial crises and local control. We saw in Flint that the city council in Flint had very little ability to manage their way out of that crisis. And now we see emergency managers who are under criminal charges. We saw a year ago the state's after-action report, the governor's official after-action report, called for reform of the emergency manager law. Throughout the year, we heard the public say the same doggone thing. Do you see any bills? Do you see this going anywhere in Lansing right now? No, because they're focused on trying to find a $1 billion tax cut.
As you look at all of this, John Bebo, and you think of the conversations you've been having with everyday people in Michigan who feel that the wheels have come off the wagon, certainly from this report, Fractured Trust, is this a result of gerrymandering?
We actually asked the public about gerrymandering and redistricting, and they're concerned. They don't feel that the districts are set up fairly and accurately now, but they also don't offer a clear mandate about what to do about it. Now, there's a real split view about how to handle that issue. So there's a lot of murkiness out there in the public, too, and this sets up a very cloudy environment going into the 2018 statewide elections here in Michigan. We're going to elect a new governor, all new Senate, all new House. At least all of those offices will be up for election. I guess if you're a leader thinking of running next year, you can either see glass half full or glass half empty here. The expectations are so low that any public leader who can come in and begin to solve some of these problems has a great upside. But the cynicism and the lack of trust is so intense right now that running for some of these statewide offices is a recipe in frustration.
What's at stake, do you think, if this doesn't get turned around, if this fractured trust is not repaired and restored?
You know, there are a number of veteran, rational, experienced leaders in this state who will whisper about whether we're becoming ungovernable. You see that in some of these numbers, the lack of trust, the sense of divide in this state, urban and rural, urban and suburban, the choices people are making. It is a very tenuous moment. I think this is my career. This is my job. I go out and talk to the public, and we do in-depth journalism. It's a scary moment. We're seeing unprecedented things on a daily basis, and I'm not saying that to criticize any politician, but some of the themes and narratives that are coming out on a daily basis. The FBI announced they are openly investigating potential ties between a presidential campaign and the Russian government. These things were almost unthinkable even a few months ago. And that cynicism, I think, is pervading so much of our state issues. I think that's what makes next year's election here in Michigan so fascinating. How do we pull out of this? How do we develop leaders that can be trusted and that are going to be responsive to public needs? That's what we're trying to do now. The centers look forward. We're doing a project throughout this year called Michigan's Divided, where we're really trying to plumb a dozen different kinds of communities in Michigan about why they distrust each other. And we're developing very lengthy fact guides about what's real in this state, tracking all kinds of metrics back decades so that we can counter this narrative of alternative news or fake news and lay out some real data there. Because we don't see any alternative. If the public is not going to believe most things, we don't see any alternative to simply continuing to produce factual information. At some point, we've got to return to facts, and we've got to return to the issues that the public wants dealt with.
Do you have any sense that our state elected officials will see this and take it to heart?
I think it depends on which elected officials you're talking about. I really commend the Snyder administration for some of the long-term work they've been doing in recent months with commissions of really statewide experts from many industries to look at the infrastructure question, to look at the future of our education system. They just released their report a couple of weeks ago. To look at the future economy. I just testified before the Economic Commission a couple of weeks ago. You know, there's no political upside in doing work that looks out 20 years, as that administration is doing right now. I think that's laudable. The question is in the legislature, where I just simply don't get this tax cut debate. And I'm not here to be a raging liberal or conservative or anything else. I'm just simply looking at the public priorities, what they tell us they want. They want infrastructure. They want affordable college. They want a better education system. What these commissions that the governor set up are saying this is going to cost, $60 billion on infrastructure, $2 billion a year on education. And what's happening under the White Dome? Let's cut the budget by $1 billion and give everybody $4 more a month. It just doesn't add up.
You and I have had a lot of these conversations about the statewide public engagement campaigns. This has really hit you, hasn't it?
Just this disconnect, this lack of connection to reality on this tax cut question, it's gotten me pretty exercised. I don't know where it's coming from. I don't know where the groundswell came from that is truly public, that is truly nonpartisan, that is truly representative of the 10 million people in this state that leads to this tax cut discussion. I simply don't get it.
John Babo is president and CEO of the Center for Michigan. The newly released report, Fractured Trust, Lost Faith in State Government and How to Restore It. You can read the report by going to their website, thecenterformichigan.net. John, thank you so much.
Thanks for having us, Cynthia.
American fiddle and banjo tunes, all nicely mixed with the music and dance tunes of Sweden, traditional and contemporary. Take that, and there you have Primo and Gustafsson.
It's interesting when you find the lyrics that's written more than 100 years ago, but you still can interpret it today.
After the break, the music of Primo and Gustafsson. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Michigan Women's Hall of Fame welcomed its latest group of honorees late last year. Among the five contemporary honorees was Dr. Olivia Letts, the first African-American teacher in the Lansing School District. That was in 1951. From that point, Dr. Letts spent her life as an advocate for education, community service, and civil rights. I spoke with her last October. Congratulations, Dr. Letts, on your induction into the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame. I'm wondering, what were your feelings when you learned that you're joining this year's class?
You know, I was very happy that I was selected to be a member, and I had a lot of support to help me.
And there were 110 nominations, so it's certainly it's great to know that you kind of, you know, stood out and are now going to be in the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame. Take us back, if you will, to when you were first hired to teach at Lincoln School in Lansing. And am I right that it was a sixth grade you were hired to teach?
Well, I was hired to teach the elementary upper grade, so I had taught fourth, fifth, and sixth because it was a very small school, so you didn't always have a full number for one grade.
Now, was this your first teaching job out of school, or had you taught elsewhere?
Oh, I taught for 3 years in Chicago. There were 2,000 students in the elementary school where I taught, so the principal thought I was wonderful. And the reason he thought I was wonderful was because I never sent a child to the office. And he saw me maybe 3 times in the whole first year.
So you took care of business in your classroom.
Correct. But I was teaching the first, second, and third grade in Chicago.
Now, what brought you to Michigan and to Lansing?
I met my husband at a wedding in Chicago that he brought his mother and sister to attend.
And love spoke, and you came to Michigan.
Well, after we dated for a year, because he worked still in Lansing. He loved Lansing as a city, and he certainly didn't wish to move to Chicago. So I was ready to move here, but I needed a job here, and they weren't hiring people of my color, so we had to work on it.
And what did that take?
Well, Attorney Dunnings, the father, Dr. Harrison, a doctor, and several other folks all went to the before the Board of Education, and I had gotten good references from the schools that I had been in Chicago, and so they decided to take a chance and hire me. And then they also decided then they could hire somebody for secondary, so they hired a secondary person as well.
Now, what are your memories, Dr. Letts, of that first year? And I'm wondering, did you encounter resistance? Were you welcomed? What happened that first year?
People came to look at me at the school, but everybody was very kind. I was treated very well. I have nothing bad to say about the way I was treated because people respected me. I respected them. I did my job. You know, I worked from 51 to 54, and my daughter was born in 54. And you did not take a leave then. You resigned. So I resigned in 1954. But I had no problem getting back in 1956 at the same school.
I'm interested, how many African American students were in your class in those early years?
All of them were, because if a Caucasian came in the morning, by afternoon, they had gone.
What do you mean?
I mean, they went to another school, so they kept it 100% African American.
Were you thinking of yourself as you were, you know, you had to, as you say, do some things to get hired, and then you came in and, as you said, you just did your job as best you could. Did you think of yourself as making a statement, as being a trailblazer, or were you just there to do your job and see where that led you?
People, you know, would say things, so I had to, you know, acknowledge the fact that I was the first African American there. But, you know, people, you know, just went about their business, and I did the same. And I taught from 56 to 61. The principal was having knee problems, and she asked me to apply for her job as principal. I did not seek a principal job. So I applied and got the job, so I got to be the first administrator in the Lansing schools.
And then went on to become director of elementary education. Dr. Letts, when you look at the teachers who have succeeded you in classrooms today in 2016, what are your biggest hopes and your biggest fears for those teachers in Michigan today?
That there aren't going to be enough of us. So few are going into education now because there are so many more options than there were back then. So I'm just afraid that we are not going to have teachers of all ethnicities in the schools. And the teachers that I know, most of them are retired now. You look at the administrators, and I'm not aware that there are a number of African-American administrators because they're not that many in the schools anymore. And I don't keep up enough to know the exact number. I've been retired, if you can believe it, for over 30 years.
Looking at your career and your lifetime of education, of what are you most proud, Dr. Letts?
You know, that's a very hard question for me to answer. I think I'm most proud of the students that I've had who have succeeded. And I still today see some of those who have succeeded. And that makes me very proud.
Dr. Olivia Letts, inducted into the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame in the fall of 2016. Take fiddle and banjo tunes from the USA and mix them up with the music and dance tunes of Sweden, and there you have Primo and Gustafsson. Our Songs from Studio East series explores music combining both contemporary and traditional music from all around the world. Primo and Gustafsson fit that bill perfectly. Laurel Primo is from the Upper Peninsula and a graduate of the University of Michigan School of Music. She's well known for her work in the American roots duo Red Tail Ring, and she plays the fiddle and banjo. Anna Gustafsson is from the Royal College of Music in Stockholm. She plays the nickel harpa. The two have been collaborating for the past 2 years, a true transatlantic collaboration. I spoke with them last November after their debut album, I Walked Abroad, was released. How do you describe the music, Anna, that you and Laurel are creating?
I think we have a core of this modal sound that is in both traditions. Also that it's often dance music, so it's quite lively and energetic and rhythmical. But also it's differences with the different rhythms and different scales. But I still feel that it has a core of something similar where we can meet musically.
And as we're about to hear, that is very, very true. How did you two find each other?
Well, 2 or 3 years ago, Anna reached out to me for another project. She was collecting some international women musicians for a grant she was writing. And that project didn't go through, but it allowed us the opportunity to meet each other just online. And I was just so excited by the idea to collaborate with Scandinavian music again. I wrote her back 6 months or a year later saying, let's do something anyways. And that's how it started. We started passing tunes back and forth right after that.
Now, when you say, again, working with Scandinavian music again, kind of remind us of some of the musical exploration you've done. I know you grew up in the Upper Peninsula.
Yeah, I feel grateful to have a little bit of experience with that before this collaboration. In the Upper Peninsula, there's so many Finnish and Swedish immigrants living there, second and third generation immigrants, and their music is predominantly the folk music that's played at community dances and things like that. So I grew up listening to that music as the normal fiddle tunes around me. And during college, I spent a little time in Finland just because I had learned, you know, I had a great desire to learn more about that Finnish music. So I studied some traditional Finnish fiddling over in Helsinki during my school years.
Well, it's time for us to listen to one of the tunes from the album. And this is a Swedish choral piece. So, Anna, you get to tell us the title and tell us what it's about.
The title is Lär mig du skog. And it's a choral, which is a religious hymn. And it's, well, the melody on this one is traditional. You don't know how old it is. Lyric was written in the 1800s. And it's about nature and to find inspiration in the different things in nature.
All right, let's take a listen. Mixing traditional and contemporary Americana and Swedish music, there's kind of a sense of a longing for home in the music and even in the way you're singing. Is that part of what underwrites that song?
Yeah, I would say it's about, it's interesting when you find a lyric that's written more than 100 years ago, but you still can interpret it today. Because especially the second verse in this song is about the birds and that you should be taught by the birds with their migration to break away and travel safely to unfamiliar shores. And this was kind of what happened also during the time the lyric was written, that a lot of Swedes were going overseas to America, and they probably longed to their home, and it was not an easy journey to make. Mm-hmm. And also today we see the same thing with other shores and other people going the same direction. So I thought it was just, it felt suitable in today too.
Describe for us, and people will be able to go to michiganradio.org and click on the video of both of you playing, but describe your instrument, the nickel harpa.
Yeah, so it's it kind of works like a violin. It has four strings that I play on with a bow, and then it also has, a bit lower down, it's 12 resonant strings that are thinner. And these resonates when I play a note, they vibrate. So it kind of sounds like a church, like the reverb comes from those strings. And then I don't know what it looks like really.
It's got someone the keys that you're kind of playing with.
We call them keys. They're made of wood, and I press them, and they go to a thing that we call leave, that's also made of wood, and that presses the string. Mm. So instead of just putting the finger on the string like a violin, you press this key, and there's three rows of these keys to the different melody strings.
It's got a beautiful sound. How much do both of you want to dig back in time, exploring traditional music, versus maybe looking ahead, making new music, writing things that are brand new? What kind of...
Maybe equal parts. We featured a lot of traditional music in this record, partially because it was our first collaboration and we wanted some groundwork and, you know, teaching each other to become familiar with our work. But maybe about half of the pieces are new pieces. You know, some that use the forms of those traditional songs and some that don't completely. So I think we're equally excited about stretching in both of those directions.
Well, let's listen to another tune from Primo and Gustafson. This one is a very traditional American tune, and it goes back at least to a legendary 19th century fiddler from West Virginia. I kind of poked around on this, a fiddler named Jack McElwain. It's called Hannah at the Springhouse. When you think of collections of folk music, and there have been some very famous ones done, Lomax, and so many of these collections, we tend to see and hear men playing and singing more than women. And here you are as female musicians in 2016 wanting to leave your mark. But why is it, do you think, that we have this impression that it was more the men who were playing?
Well, I think it's like that with almost every subject. If you see history books or books of art, it's the same. It's usually men that have had these jobs that to write the books or to collect the music and go out and to record the musician. And they often chose to record men because they thought they were better or something. I mean, there was a lot of women playing, and also, in Sweden, we have a strong tradition of the herding music, which was almost only females, and that was a long time ago. But we kind of had this base of the music comes from that. But the only thing we see in the history books is maybe this male fiddlers.
What do you think we gain by keeping those traditional lyrics and traditional melodies alive?
Well, there's a certain power behind it being old, and certainly the songs that we're able to find now are the ones that kind of rose to the top. So they are the cream of the crop, the ones that have been orally passed down to us. So I don't know. It's just powerful to me to have roots in something.
And I think maybe with the lyrics and that could teach us something, both about how it was to live back then, but also a lot of these songs has things we can learn from today too. So I think these tunes and songs are staying alive for a reason, because they're still played today. So
they're timeless. The album is I Walked Abroad from Laurel Primo and Anna Gustafson, and you can find out more at their website, primogustafson.com. That's primogustafson.com. Congratulations on a beautiful album and making some beautiful music.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
You.
Up next, 18 seasons in the NFL, 11 as a Detroit Lion. He's got himself a Super Bowl ring, but Lomas Brown might never have had his football career without some help from his school principal.
He called me over to him and he asked me, did you sign up for varsity sports? And I was like, no, what is varsity sports?
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. From a band kid growing up in Florida to a fearsome offensive tackle who played 18 seasons in the NFL, including 11 years with the Detroit Lions, Lomas Brown has a story to tell. He was named to the Pro Bowl for seven straight seasons, and he got his Super Bowl ring with Tampa Bay. Lomas Brown first came to Michigan when he was drafted by the Lions in 1985, and he's still here despite the snow and the cold winters. His memoir, co-authored with Mike Eisenberg, is titled If These Walls Could Talk, Stories from the Detroit Lions Sideline, Locker Room, and Press Box. I spoke with him last November. Lomas, what made you decide that now was the right time for you to write your memoir?
Well, to be honest with you, Mike Eisenberg is really the reason why. He really pushed me to doing it, because I really didn't think I had a story to tell. And he kept pushing me and saying, no, you do have a story to tell. And people would be interested in hearing things about your career, and especially around in the Detroit area, since this is the area I live in. So, you know, through his urging, we started.
You know what's really cool about the way that you and Mike structured the book is you tell your story, but there's kind of like the Greek chorus, if you will, of all kinds of people throughout the Lions in your career who kind of chime in with their views of you.
Yes, and that's why I love the book the most. That's how I love, because how it was written, how Mike sat down, how it was put together. Like you say, it's not an autobiography. It's not just coming from my view. It's coming from other guys that were in that locker room, coaches, different players outside the organization that happened to be looking inside the organization. That's where it's coming from. So it's a collaboration of a lot of different people, their perspectives on how things went. And I kind of put a little bit more into it from my point of view, but I thought it was well written, too.
It's fun to read, and it really does take us inside the locker room in good times and in bad.
That's
and God knows there were bad years, and we'll get into that. But I want to start with your beginning. I had to love the fact you were a kid, not a football player.
Right.
Shout out to you. Being a band kid, second chair trombone.
Right.
I was second chair French horn.
Hey,
so.
All right.
So who pointed you to football?
Well, you know, it was my principal. It was a principal. He's not here with us any longer. His name was Alex Bromere. And a funny story, what happened was the first day of school, I went in and signed up for classes. I'm coming out the auditorium. Someone says, hey, I turn around, and it's the principal. I didn't know that at the moment, but he called me over to him, and he asked me, did you sign up for varsity sports? And I was like, no, what is varsity sports? So he just grabbed me by the arm and took me back in there, and he signed me up for it. So I had to wait till the end of the day. It was the last class, and come to find out it was football that he signed me up for. So I'm like, wow. It was just him. It was his – he was the reason why I started started football. And I thank that man every time I would see him, because if not for him, I know no telling where I would have been at.
You know what? What a real testament to the power of the right word from the right teacher at the right time.
That's
that
right.
Something else. So we're going to roll ahead a few years. You discover you'd been drafted by Detroit. What did you know about Detroit? What were your thoughts?
You know, nothing. I knew it was cold. I knew y'all made automobiles up here. And at that time, I hate to say it, was like the Myrtle Capital, you know.
80s were rough.
Yeah, it was rough up here. So I didn't have any idea what I was stepping into. But I knew, you know, it was a team that had only won 4 games the year before. So the team wasn't doing well. So it just seemed like, you know, it was going to be a challenge. And especially for me growing up down south my whole life, you know, having to get acclimated to the climate up here. You know, just everything was so different up here. Everything moved faster up here. So it was just so different from my upbringing, how I was brought up. But I was happy that I got the contrast, because I got to see how the Midwest live, and I loved it. I loved it, and I still love it today.
And you're still here today.
That's right.
Your book has so many inside stories and views of people you've encountered while you were aligned. So let's do a pop quiz and get your quick views on some of these folks. Mm-hmm. Barry Sanders.
Okay, everybody say I'm biased. The best running back I've ever seen play, and the best running back that I've ever played with, and just the best person, just humble. You know, I blocked for Barry for 7 of his 10 years and never once. And, you know, Barry took a lot of losses and everything. He took a lot of losses. I never once heard him get up, point his fingers, or say anything bad to the players or to an offensive lineman. And that's a testimony to him, because I've been around running backs. I've been around people that have really not been good people. But him, he's just been an excellent person. And that's why we would do any and everything we could to make sure that guy succeeded, because he was just that type of person.
Were you surprised when he walked away?
I wasn't surprised when he walked away. I really wasn't. I think a lot of people thought he was coming back. I knew he wasn't going to come back, because I knew how Barry was. Barry's a person of his conviction. Barry, once he walks away, once he set his mind to something, that's it. He's not going to come back. I knew he wasn't coming back. I knew the game of football had played this path with him. And I'm going to tell you one thing, Cindy, that really was telling to me is when I went to his Hall of Fame induction. And he said there at this Hall of Fame, he said, "I didn't choose football. Football chose me." And for this guy to give 10 years, 10 of the best years that the Lions fans have probably ever seen out of one player, and do that, and really, you know, he didn't choose football. You know, football chose him, but to play at that level, that gave me so much more respect for him to put his body in harm's way for 10 years. And he was able to walk away on top, and that's what I'm happy about for Barry.
Someone who has been in this studio through his work at the U of M Anti-Depression Center,
that's
Eric
right.
Hipple.
Yes.
What do you want to say about Eric
Hipple? You
know, Hipple?
That, and another great guy. I came in, he was already here, and it was funny. At that time in 1985, $500,000 was a lot, and that's what Eric was making. And we used to walk by his locker, me and Kevin Glover, and used to look at his locker and be like, wow, this guy makes $500,000. It was just such a big number to us back in the day, and now compared to now, that's just a drop in the hat. But another guy that went through a lot, persevered. That's that. When I think about Eric, perseverance is the word that really comes to mind with him. With all the stuff he went through with it, losing his son, which is something I just couldn't imagine, losing a child. But losing his son, then what he went through.
With his own depression battle.
Depression, yeah. And, you know, how he's come through it. And now he's kind of the guiding light to help other guys, not just in the league, but guys in the Army, in our armed services.
Students.
Students. And he's touching people all over, not just in the state of Michigan. And I couldn't have been proud of Eric for how things have really turned around for him.
Scott Mitchell.
You know what, Cindy, you know, with me and Scott, we've talked maybe twice since everything with the ESPN thing and everything. And we've talked, and the thing I say about Scott, you know what I would say with him? I would say, use the word victim with him. And the reason why I would use the word victim with him is because we were a locker room. If you think about it, in 1991, we had got to the championship game, one game from the Super Bowl getting there. You know, we had a lot of tragedies and injuries that kind of hurt the team the following years that kind of had us going up and down. When they brought Scott in, they dropped Scott in the locker room full of guys ready to win. I don't think the organization equipped Scott the right way to come in there, meaning I don't think they told Scott the type of locker room he was coming into, the type of environment he was coming to, where he was coming into a locker room full of hungry guys. We were hungry. We were ready to win. We were on the cusp.
Fans were hungry.
Absolutely. Yeah. They've been hungry. We were looking at the Dallas Cowboys, and if you think about it, we had beat them in 91, beat them down, and our team was similar to their team. The only thing we needed was a quarterback. They had the great receiver. We had Herman Moore. We had Barry Sanders. They had Emmitt Smith. They had Troy Aikman. We needed our Troy Aikman to get us over the hump. And I think when they brought Scott in, they didn't let him know how it was, how hungry we were, how ready this team was. And I just don't think his attitude, I just don't think his hunger and desire was the same as ours in that locker room. And that was a complete conflict. That conflicted us. And anytime your leader, the leader of your team, isn't on the same page with the rest of the guys, it's not going to work. And you know, we had a couple of good years with Scott, but I just think things could have been a lot better. And when I talked to Scott years later, he told me he was going through a lot of personal things, which we didn't know. And again, if he'd have known the type of locker room he was in, he would have known that he could have came to us guys and told us, because everybody was going through stuff. I went through a divorce while I was with the Lions. Everybody goes through things, but that's what your teammates are there for, to hold you up, to help you go through those tough times. But your teammates have to know. And I just think, you know, through him not knowing us, through us not knowing him, that just never worked out that way.
There are a lot of insights, and it's interesting that he is one of the folks who does contribute to your book with some quotes, so that's worth it. You were right there the day Mike Utley suffered that hit that left him paralyzed. What do you remember about that moment?
You know what? The thing I remember the most is, and I was hurt, Cindy, so I had hurt my shoulder. I think I got hurt the game before against Tampa Bay, so I was on the sideline. And when Mike went down, you know, he was down for a while. And I just remember, you know, us just standing on the sideline, you know, just watching. But then it started taking a little longer than normal. And I didn't really get tipped off until I seen Kevin Glover walking off the field. And it looked like he was crying. And when I seen that, that's when it really hit me that something was really, really wrong with Mike. And then, of course, you know, them putting him on the stretcher. Yeah. And then, of course, the iconic, him giving us the thumbs up, going off the field. It was just so, you know, football brings you a lot of things. And, you know, of course, losing is one of the things. And you never like to lose a game. But when you lose a teammate, when you lose a brother, when you lose a friend, and lose him the way we lost Mike, it still resonates to this day. He's one of my best friends. I talk to him frequently. Matter of fact, he was just up here 2 weeks ago. Me, him, his wife, and my wife went to have lunch along with Tim Pendel and some other people. And it was just great seeing him. And know what, Cindy? He still says he's going to walk. He said that the day we went to visit him in the hospital room after his accident, and here it is, I don't know how many years, 20-some-odd years later, he still said he's going to walk, and that's the type of person he is.
Lomas, what is it like when things are going badly and, you know, you go out there and the losing streak is just, it stinks the place up. You have fans sitting there with bags over there.
Yes.
How much does that hit you players?
Oh, it hits, and that's a great question, Cindy, because I don't think how people think it affects the players, but
you care.
Oh, you have to. This is your profession. This is your profession. You have to care. And you think about, you got guys coming up every year at the college ranks. You got guys from other teams coming in that can take your job. So it's super, super competitive. So when you lose, you should feel it like that. I remember we used to wouldn't go eat. Man, your food didn't taste well. You know, you treated your family a little differently than you would because you're upset about things.
People probably giving you a little lip when you're out. I saw that happen. I can't think who it was at a Starbucks.
Yep.
And I was behind him in line, and people were like, well, thanks a lot.
See? It happens. I mean, it happens. I remember once back in, this probably had to be 93 or so, I had got hurt bad ankle sprain. I missed like 4 weeks. But I was supposed to miss 6 weeks. And I tried to come back earlier and got re-injured in the game. And I remember my wife, she was in the stands, and she was telling me some of the stuff, you know, that was being said, you know, about me, you know, from the fans. But again, you know, you invest so much. The fans, they invest so much. Their hard-earned money and their time, you know, with the players, they invest so much. Their time and everything, their bodies. And when things don't go right, there's a high level of frustration, not just for the fans, but for the players, the coaches, everybody. Just nothing is right when you're on a losing streak or things don't go well over there. Just nothing is right. So it's all. Always, they say winning cures all. That's the truth.
You know, after you left the Lions, you played in Arizona, Cleveland, New York, finally Tampa Bay, Super Bowl 37. What told you it was time to call it a career?
Well, when I was with the Cleveland Browns, I signed a 3-year deal with Cleveland. That was the first team that ever cut me, You know, out of my years, they just said they just cut me and stuff, and it hurt me. It was probably one of the lowest points, other than losing the Super Bowl, that I had. And I remember driving back to Detroit, and I remember Jim Fossil from the New York Giants, coach calling me, and he was calling me saying, hey, I want you to come out to New York and come see us and everything. And I'm telling Coach, no. I think I'm going to retire. I was in my 15th year. I'm 30-some years old. I think I'm going to retire. And I remember him telling me, just come. Just come out and see it. Went out and seen it, and that the rest was history. I never turned back. That was the first Super Bowl I had ever got to. If I wouldn't have signed with them, I would have never got to my first Super Bowl, even though I ended up losing it. Yeah. And it's just the same way with Tampa Bay. I was signed with Tampa Bay a day before they went to training camp. Wasn't sure I was going to sign with them, but I remember it was the hottest year. That's when Corey Stringer had died that year, and there was a big thing with hydrating players and watching the temperature. And I remember down in Tampa, it was brutal. Oh, my goodness.
You'd acclimated to this Michigan weather.
That's right.
Florida
I sure
kid.
Was. And I was older, and it was brutal. And I remember calling my mother and telling her, I think I'm going to retire. I think this is it. You know, I don't know if I should be out here doing this. And she talked me into staying. And I stayed, and I say that to say if I wouldn't have stayed, I would have never got my Super Bowl ring. So when I knew at that point, once I got my Super Bowl ring, it was time for me to go. I had put in my 18 years. Yeah. I had been blessed to get it in my last year. My body was physically wearing down. The guys were getting bigger and stronger and faster. You know, the game was moving a lot faster. So you kind of know when all these things come into effect, you start knowing that it's coming to an end. And I'm glad I was able to get my ring, because it probably, if it wasn't for that, I probably would have tried to hang on a few more years to try to get in, and no telling how it would have ended up. So I'm glad I was able to go out on top getting the ring.
And on that high note, Lomas Brown, number 75, his memoir with Mike Eisenberg is titled If These Walls Could Talk, Stories from the Detroit Lions Sideline, Locker Room, and Press Box. Such a pleasure, Lomas. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroff. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Cass Adair, Lee Smesmer, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.